You're listening to the FQXI podcast.
Another month, another FQXI podcast, bringing news from the world of foundational physics. So, Brendan, how are you feeling today?
Actually, I'm feeling very particular. Thank you for asking. How about you?
Me? I'm wavy today, with a little bit of particle thrown in. A veritable mix of identities.
How very quantum mechanical of you. Whatever you do, don't collapse while we're recording.
I'll try not to. We are, of course, referring to the peculiar quantum property in which particles can behave like waves.
And waves can behave like particles.
This phenomenon, known as wave-particle duality, has been confirmed in the lab many times over. But it's been making the headlines this past month because two groups of physicists have carried out tests, published in the journal Science, that demonstrate this effect even more resoundingly. Those experiments also highlight the strange way that photons experience time, or rather, the way that they don't experience time. We'll talk about what made those experiments so clever in a little bit.
But first, to set up the wave-particle mood, we're talking about other experiments that test when this quantum property breaks down, being carried out by Hendrik Ulbricht, a physicist at the University of Southampton, UK. Physicists have seen wavy behavior in relatively large objects in the lab, including some organic molecules, which begs the question if large-ish molecules show signs of wave-particle duality, why don't we? Is there a boundary beyond which objects are too big to sustain quantum effects? And if so, where does it lie? Ulbricht, along with Tejinder Singh of the Tata Institute in Mumbai, India, and Angelo Bassi at the University of Trieste, have been speaking with reporter Karin Pikama about their tests to find the edge of the quantum world.
In 1921, Einstein was awarded a Nobel Prize in Physics, not for his theories of relativity, but for his discovery of the law of photoelectric effect. This law turned out to be crucial for the formulation of quantum theory. Since then, quantum theory, which explains the nature and behavior of matter and energy on the atomic and subatomic level, is seen as the foundation of all modern science and technology. But the theory has one major issue that continues to make some physicists uncomfortable. It's unpredictable. In simple terms, this means that it is possible for small particles to be in more than one place at the same time. For small particles, this may not be a problem, but scaled up to the classical world, the world we perceive, this breaks down. No object, including ourselves, can ever be in two places at the same time. This unpredictability of quantum theory bothered Einstein, and he summed his frustration up in the now famous quote, "God does not play dice." Tejinder Singh, a theoretical physicist at the Tata Institute of Fundamental Research in Mumbai, shares Einstein's sentiment.
He was never satisfied with quantum theory, and for good reason. And yet he became, almost ostracized to the extent of being labeled getting old. But all along he had a point, and what we are doing now seems to go very much in the direction, in a certain sense, that he was proposing, that quantum theory is approximate.
Together with theoretical physicist Angelo Bassi and experimentalist Hendrik Ulbricht, Singh wants to modify quantum theory so it can explain nature more precisely. With the help of a grant from the Foundational Questions Institute, Ulbricht is getting ready to test the theories from Singh and Bassi in his laboratory in Southampton in the UK. I caught up with all three to find out how the research is going.
My name is Angelo Bassi. I am a theoretical physicist, and right now I'm working at the University of Trieste. In a way, quantum mechanics is the theory, the only theory we have in our hands so far, capable to describe the behavior of microscopic systems. So particles, atoms, molecules, and in some cases, also large collections of them. The way the theory was developed at the beginning of the 20th century was such that you are in principle allowed to talk only about the outcome of measurements. So perhaps a good orthodox definition of quantum theory would be is the theory that just tells you how to predict the outcome of measurements related to microscopic systems. So it doesn't have, in principle, nothing to say about the systems, but only about the measurements on the systems.
While this theory has been supported time and again over the past century, as Einstein already pointed out, there are nonetheless still real unresolved paradoxes in the very basics of the theory.
One of the most important problems is the so-called measurement problem. So why quantum mechanics is linear? So if you have two possibilities, you can have also the superposition of the two possibilities. The usual example is a Schrödinger cat. The cat can be dead, the cat can be alive. So also the superposition dead plus alive should be possible according to the theory. But we don't experience such things in nature.
The obvious difference between the quantum world and the classical world is size. This raises a string of interesting questions for Singh.
So we ask, why is that so? Why is that big objects, which are actually made up of small objects in any case, cannot be found in more than one place at the same time? And how big is big? A table may have, let's say, a few billion atoms, and we can call it big. How many atoms should I put together before a small thing becomes big?
Finding out when big is big and small is small might be key in solving the problem of superposition. And finding the exact boundary between them is precisely what Singh, Ulbricht and Bassi aim to do.
The global proposal is to test somehow the limits of validity of quantum mechanics, and in particular of the superposition principle, which is the most fundamental property of the theory among the many. So to test this property towards the microscopic scale. So at the microscopic level, the principle works. This has been tested frequently, daily, basically, in laboratories. At the macroscopic level, it seems not to work. So the idea is that in between the micro and the macro, the principle should break down. Hendrik is working on the experimental side. So to build up an experiment in the intermediate region between microsystems, so atoms, and macrosystems, so the Schrödinger cat. So work with this system in between, make them superimpose, and see whether the superposition remains in time or decays fast or slow.
Hi, it's Hendrik. What the theory basically includes in its basis, it says that every object in nature can be wave or particle, and it simply depends on what kind of experiment we do, if this object shows us a particle behavior or wave behavior.
This duality, where waves can be particles and particles can be waves, has interesting consequences. When a crest or highest point of one wave collides with the trough or lowest point of another wave, the two waves cancel each other out. It's called interference. Because particles can also be waves, this is true for them as well. Interference can be tested in a double slit experiment. To understand what happens in this experiment, try imagining a house with a big fence around it at night time. The fence obscures the house completely, except for three gaps where the planks of the fence don't quite match up. With the help of a street lamp, you manage to peek through one of the gaps to get a good look at the house, and you notice something funny about the light that filters through the other two gaps. There are not two, but several strips of light projected onto the wall of the house. As waves of light from the street lamp hit the fence and seep through both gaps, some of the waves collide and cancel each other out on the other side of the fence, while others are reinforced, causing this unexpected light pattern to appear on the wall. Now, if you were to shoot massive particles, like paintballs for instance, at the same two gaps in the fence, some would slip through, leaving two neat strips of paint on the house. But if we scale these giant paintball particles down to the size of electrons and shoot them at the fence, the pattern on the wall becomes multi-striped again. For this to have happened, the electrons must have behaved like waves.
What we want to do is we want to generate a stream of very massive particles. So these are, in our experiment, little polystyrene spheres, little balls. And they have a diameter of up to 100 nanometers, and they are relatively massive. And the question is if we can do a double slit experiment with those particles exactly in the same way as it has been done with light.
The largest particle that still shows interference, and so still belongs to the quantum world, is 7,000 times heavier than a hydrogen atom. To test particles heavier than this, Ulbricht has to overcome huge technological difficulties.
We have a particle source, so we can generate particles in an optical trap. So the experiment has to be done under very clean conditions. So that means that the particle has to be alone, which means the particle has to be in ultra-high vacuum, which is at very low pressure. So 10 to minus 10 millibar is the pressure we have to reach in a vacuum chamber. And what we are now working on is to basically bring this trapped particle into the vacuum chamber. Yeah, so that this would be a big technological step. We don't have a solution at the moment, but we are working on it.
But getting the particle into the vacuum chamber isn't Ulbricht's only problem. Once the particle is in place, he needs to adjust the double slit experiment to make it possible to test the larger particles.
You have to realize a double slit for this single particle so that when we release the part, it falls through the double slit just in the gravitational field of the Earth. But there are many complicated challenges and problems which we have to overcome to do this experiment.
But despite these difficulties in finding at which point exactly quantum theory might break down, the group has already started thinking about why superposition doesn't seem to exist in the classical world. One idea that they are excited about has also been championed by Roger Penrose, a mathematical physicist at the University of Oxford. Here's Singh again.
Many of us, all three of us in the team and a few others, including people like Roger Penrose, believe that gravity has a lot to do with why large things look classical. Parts of our theory do show that gravity is what is responsible preventing a table from being in two places at the same time.
And here's Bassi again to explain why gravity might hold the answers.
If you want to kill quantum superposition at the macroscopic level, so that Schrödinger cat is not dead and alive, but just either dead or alive, then you need some nonlinear phenomena. Your superposition principle is linear. If you want to kill the superposition, you need something nonlinear. And gravity precisely has this character. The theory underlying gravity, which is general relativity, is a strongly nonlinear theory. So if you have two possible curvature of space-time, the superposition is not a solution of the equation, so it's not a possibility predicted by the theory anymore. And this is precisely the idea of Roger Penrose. When you create a quantum superposition, so cat, for example, in one room and cat in the other room, then you have two different gravitational potentials created by the cat, and gravity doesn't like these two superpositions of gravitation and kills them.
If Ulbricht does find in his experiments that there is a point at which particles are so large that they no longer also behave as waves, quantum theory will need to be modified. A century after Einstein raised his concerns with quantum theory, we might finally learn that God does indeed not play dice. While many scientists might be reluctant to modify quantum mechanics, physicists like Bassi relish the idea of change.
We live, in some sense, in one of the most exciting moments in the history of science, because we come from a past of amazing successes. So there was classical mechanics, then we had in 100 years, we had such revolutions as statistical mechanics, special relativity, general relativity, quantum mechanics. So we have a completely different understanding of the world, and this is very exciting. But it's clear, at least in my eyes, that we are missing an important piece of information about the world around us, and we should look for something else. And this is really, I mean, it's amazing that we are in this position.
Thank you to Heinrich Ulbricht, to Jinder Singh and Angelo Bassi for speaking with Corinne Pickemer there. You can read more about Ulbricht's experiments in an article on the website, www.fqxi.org/community/podcast.
I liked Corinne's description of the classical double slit experiment that is used to demonstrate wave-particle duality. A variation on that experiment was proposed in the 1980s by physicist John Wheeler to try and catch out photons, or particles of light, in the act of deciding whether to behave as particles or as waves. His proposal for what's known as a delayed choice experiment has recently been modified and tested by two groups, one based in the UK and one based in France, who have shown that photons retain their dual identity even when you try to trick them.
Yes, so the standard double slit experiment can also be carried out by firing light from a laser at the wall with two slits. Now, historically, light was thought of as a wave anyway, so it might not seem that exciting to discover that when a beam of light hits the two slits, it splits into two waves that proceed beyond the wall and interact on the other side, creating a characteristic interference pattern that can be picked up on a background screen. The strange part really appears when you tune down the laser so that it only spits out one photon, so one particle of light, at a time. In that case, you might expect the wave interference pattern to disappear because a single particle of light can only travel through one slit, either the left slit or the right slit.
Right. So basically, because you're shooting single photons at the slits, like bullets fired from a gun, you'd expect that roughly half would go through one slit and half would go through the other. And if you look at a screen lying beyond the wall, you'd expect to just see two clusters of light lined up with the two slits. You would not expect to see wave interference at all.
But what you actually see is that the interference pattern remains. Even a single photon exhibits wave-like behavior, somehow traveling through both slits at the same time, splitting and interfering with itself on the other side of the screen to build up that characteristic wave pattern.
That's not all, because photons do not like being spied on. So if you place a photon detector at each slit to try and see which path the photon takes and how it manages this feat of traveling through both slits at once, well, then the obstinate photon reverts to behaving like a particle that travels through only one slit and not the other, and the wave interference pattern vanishes.
Very crudely put, it's as though the photon approaches the double slit and makes a note of whether or not there's a photon detector sitting there waiting for it. If there is, the photon decides to act like a particle and pass through one slit. If not, the photon decides to act wavy and pass through both.
Which is just crazy. And finally gets us to the delayed choice experiment outlined by John Wheeler, which is designed to fool the photon, forcing it to make its choice over whether to act as a wave or a particle before the experimenter tips it off about whether or not she is going to measure its path. Wheeler suggested that instead of placing photon detectors at the slit, you could move them farther away. In his setup, the experimenter only chooses whether or not to use these detectors to gather information about which path the photon took after the photon has already passed through the slits. So the photon, in theory, should have to decide whether to behave as a wave or a particle before knowing whether the person carrying out the experiment intends to spy on the photon's path or not.
Cunning. So, does it work? Can you outwit the photon in this way?
Well, no, evidently not. A couple of weeks ago, two teams, one led by Florian Kaiser at the French CNRS Institute and the other by Alberto Peruzzo at the University of Bristol, UK, showed that photons cannot be outfoxed by performing tests that were a kind of variation on this one. They didn't use the exact setup that we outlined here, and this isn't the first time Wheeler's delayed choice experiment has been carried out, but the two tests confirmed again that photons can seemingly delay the choice. The choice about whether or not they behaved like particles or waves in an experiment carried out earlier, based on lab measurements that are made after the photon already exited the apparatus. There are links to the papers that appeared in Science on the website www.fqxi.org/community/podcast.